welcome to Travel Fun. My name is Mary Beth Clementi, and I'm the host of this talk show on travel. And this week I have documentarian, master documentarian Ken Burns in the studio, and I'm really thrilled about that. I have to say I'm one of his biggest fans. And Ken is in Telluride for the Telluride Film Festival that is celebrating its 36th year, and he is certainly a pivotal part of that. We'll be talking about his connection to Telluride, to the film festival, and also his upcoming series of the National Parks, America's Best Idea. I'd like to welcome Ken Burns to Travel Fun. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Mary Beth. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Let's talk about the National Parks, that project.
It's been a labor of love for 10 years. We've been working on it for that long, and we've been shooting for 6 years. It's a six-part, 12-hour history of the national parks that begins broadcast on PBS on September 27th and runs for 6 to 8 days. And I emphasize the word history because when you talk about the national parks, most people think of them as travelogues or nature films, and this is not. This is a history of the ideas and the individuals that made this uniquely American thing happen. For the first time in human history, in all of human experience, land was set aside not for kings or for noblemen or the very rich, but for everybody and for all time. And it's a purely democratic idea. Couldn't have happened in any other country that wasn't struggling to figure out whether their own people could run the show. And in fits and starts, we've been trying to figure out how to do this. But if you think about it, how hard it was to create national parks, it makes this series not just pretty pictures of wildlife, but this incredibly dramatic struggle. Most people look at a beautiful river and they think dam. They look at a beautiful stand of trees and they think bored feet. They look at a beautiful canyon and they wonder what mineral wealth they can extract from it. And so the people who were able to set aside these national parks fought battles for people they would never meet, meaning us, you and me, and untold, unborn generations who enjoy the beauty of this co-ownership of the national parks. And that's what the series is about.
I was fortunate enough to see the last in the series on the big screen when you showed it here at Mountain Film. And I was just blown away. And of course, I went in there like so many people expecting to see gorgeous panoramas and vistas and landscapes and all of that. And that I did see. It was marvelous. But I didn't expect to have my heartstrings pulled the way they were.
You know, at the heart of the national parks, we sort of think of them as these Teddy Roosevelt in conservation. Well, they began as spiritual things. People just thought, I could worship God, not in cathedrals built by man, as our European tradition tells us, but in these natural cathedrals like Yosemite and Zion and other places like that. So at the heart of the national park idea or compact is that I have these personal, we can all have these personal transformations. And so each one of the 50 or so people we focus on in the film, the historical characters, excuse me, had a transformational awakening in the national parks, from John Muir to everyone else. And our story essentially interbraids these 50 or so people against the backdrop of the national parks. But every one of the so-called experts that we interviewed to help us understand those historical characters also had their molecules rearranged in the national parks. And every one of us who worked on this film had it too. And we found, you know, after doing films on war, you'd think that that would be the places where most emotion would come from. We never expected the kind of emotional response to the stories we've told and to the responses we had trying to figure out how to tell these stories. People coming out of that last screening in tears because so much of our relationship to the parks are personal. Our parents took us. We took our kids. It's where we had a glimpse of ourselves free from the tyranny of the ordinary, free from the momentum of our daily lives, which are now overwhelmed in a virtual existence of Facebook and texting and video games and all the stuff that particularly distracts our kids. But we've been out in nature, and this great paradox happens. We feel our insignificance standing there in Canyonlands or in the rim of the Grand Canyon, and yet that makes us feel bigger, a part of all things. And we share a kinship with all the other human beings, as John Muir would say, of that sense of the parks, just as the egotist in our midst is always diminished by his or her self-regard, we're made bigger when we feel that humility, and the parks do that to us. And so we were flabbergasted by the response.
Did you go into this project thinking that you were going to have the story, or I should say the better part of the story, told by the people behind it? That, of course, is very Ken Burns-like. Was that your original intention?
You know, we never make films about subjects we know about. I mean, that's homework. You know, here's what you should know. We'd rather share with you our process of discovery. Hey, guess what we just learned? Here's the story of this amazing person. He's the son of a slave. He helped save Biscayne Bay. Or this Japanese-American photographer, immigrant who helped save the Smoky Mountains. Or there's this Native American story, or Hispanic biologist, or this guy, Stephen Mather, who was the first director of the Park Service. Or John Muir. You can't imagine how great John Muir is. And even Teddy Roosevelt, what you think you know, throw it all out. He's even more spectacular in his devotion to the parks than you could possibly imagine. So our job is to sort of contain that enthusiasm. And that's what the story of this is. We had no idea what to expect. And we go in just wanting to tell a good story. And in this case, it's intertwining literally dozens and dozens of stories. It's sort of like a Russian novel. It's not set against the backdrop of some horrible war. It's set against the backdrop of some of the most spectacular scenery on earth, but those stories are complicated, conflict-filled, and ultimately, I think, inspiring.
It wouldn't be an interview with Ken Burns if I didn't ask you about the Ken Burns effect.
This is a story of the technological tail wagging the dog. Many, many years ago, Steve Jobs called me up and asked me to visit him in Cupertino, California, which I did. Every person on Earth would do that. He's one of the most interesting and fascinating people I've ever met. And he and his engineers were perfecting something that the working title was the Ken Burns effect, and it permitted people in all future Mac computers to be able to pan and zoom as I do and have done for the last 30 years as a way to not just hold these old photographs as sort of static at arm's length, but to get inside and make them come alive. And that's what I've tried to do, and add complex sound effects and all the things. So, you know, every Mac computer was going to have this in the next couple months, and they wanted to keep the name, the Ken Burns Effect. And I said, oh, you know, I don't do commercial endorsements, you know. But we worked out a thing where they give me some equipment and I give it to some nonprofits, some educational groups, and a nonprofit that my wife started called Room to Grow, which helps right now in New York City and in Boston, children born into poverty. And we give them computer equipment. And so I feel good about that. But the funny thing is, I'm a relative Luddite, you know, and I walk by an Apple store and people pile out and they come to me to tell me all these things they've done with the Ken Burns effect. And I have to sort of cross my eyes and assume this kind of Yoda inscrutable thing and sort of kind of course you do, and get the hell out of Dodge quickly before they understand what a fraud I am. But that's the Ken Burns effect. But at the heart of it, at the heart of what I was originally trying to do, was to take an old photograph, perhaps the only evidence we have of a past moment, whether it's the Civil War or the national parks, and make it come alive. To not just look at it and move into it, to treat it like a feature filmmaker word with a wide shot, a close shot, a medium shot, a tilt, a pan, a reveal, but to listen to it. Are the troops tramping? Are the birds singing? Are the bats cracking at the baseball game? Are the crowds cheering? And to will that old photograph alive. And that's truly what that impulse was that we were trying to do with using those old photographs for the last 35 years the way we have.
Well, you certainly do it very well. Let's get back to talking about the national parks. What had surprised me a little bit in the last piece I saw was the national parks encompasses much more than people realize.
Absolutely. You know, in the beginning, we saved spectacular natural scenery, the greatest highest free-falling waterfall in the continent at Yosemite, the greatest collection of geysers on the planet, the grandest canyon on Earth. But the idea, just like democracy evolved, when Thomas Jefferson said all men are created equal, he meant all white men of property. Now, we don't mean that now. We've expanded that. And the parks have grown, too. They began to save archaeological sites of the ancient Pueblo cultures here well before us. They began to save historic sites like the battlefields of the Civil War. They moved into diverse habitats. The Everglades was just a swamp. Well, it also turns out to be the only place where crocodiles and alligators coexist. It's the only place where you find this delicate array of bromeliads and orchids and birds beyond number, ibises and herons and egrets and anhingas, and the wood stork, the only stork common to North America. It's an amazing, abundant place. And we said, well, I guess it doesn't have waterfalls or geysers erupting, but it could be a national park too. And then we set aside shrines, the Statue of Liberty, the Lincoln Memorial, Mount Rushmore. We have wild and scenic rivers. We have monuments that don't yet have national park status, places that we've set aside, like Grand Staircase Escalante in Utah. We've got places of shame. You know, a great country has a complicated history, and if you acknowledge it, you're an even greater country. And so Manzanar, where Japanese Americans were shamelessly interned, where German Americans and Italian Americans were not during the Second World War, is a unit of the National Park Service. So is Central High School, still a working inner-city high school in Little Rock, Arkansas, where in 1957 the crisis of school desegregation crystallized, is also a unit. So Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where United 93 went down. So is Oklahoma City, the site of the greatest act of domestic terrorism. So are slave cabins, as well as the plantations, the homes of the people who made the comfortable life of the slave owner possible. And so what you've seen is a continually enlarging view of what a national park or a National Park Service site could be. And that's to our great and everlasting credit. It's not just the beautiful geological history. It's not just the complicated ethnographic, but it's now our political and social and military history that includes the undertow, the stuff that many of us would perhaps not like to take into account. But unlike any other country on earth, we're willing to look ourselves in the eye and say, you know what? This is how we were. We did tolerate slavery. We didn't treat women as equals. We have treated other people of different ethnic backgrounds as inferior citizens. But we have learned from these mistakes. We are learning from these mistakes. And we can be a better union, as the Constitution suggests.
I am visiting with Ken Burns. I think I can easily say the country's best known documentarian. You have done some wonderful, wonderful works. And we're talking about the upcoming series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea, that is airing end of September on PBS. And I think we should provide the website. Mm-hmm. PBS.org.
PBS.org/theparks. And we've got a wonderful website. One of our funders, the Evelyn and Walter Haas Jr. Fund, helped helped us produce it with some grants, but they also insisted that our educational outreach be that much bigger, because so many of the heroes of the national parks come from diverse backgrounds. It isn't just the story of a top-down history of famous white guys bestowing the parks on us. Those famous white guys like Theodore Roosevelt and John D. Rockefeller Jr. and the first director of the Park Service, Stephen Mather, are important, and we tell their story. But this is a bottom-up story that's black and brown and red and yellow and female and unknown, as well as white and male and famous. And we tell that story, and we can now go into communities, African-American and Hispanic communities, and show the kids in schools heroes that look and sound like them. And this isn't some politically correct gesture. This is the truth. The first biologist of the National Park Service was a Hispanic gentleman named George Melendez Wright that changed us from this horrible policy of killing the wolves and the other predators and feeding the bears like they were pets, by the side of the road, to a place in which we respected the complex interrelationship of all the living things within a national park, and reintroduced in many cases the long-hated predators into places like Yellowstone. And you can now, on a cold winter morning, hear that mournful howl of a wolf, which is exactly the way it should be.
There really is so much to talk about. And of course, the 100-year anniversary of the national parks isn't too far away.
Well, it's actually the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. It started in 1916, so we're coming up, and there's a huge centennial challenge. There's been huge neglect for the last 8 years of the national parks, nearly $8 billion backlog of maintenance that could be done tomorrow that we need to have constituents, people visiting the parks and saying, hey, I want them up to snuff. These are the crown jewels. Let's polish these crown jewels. But it also begs a question. People have always assumed the parks have been there. They haven't. They always assume that the National Park Service has always been there. They haven't. So the National Park Service doesn't show up in our series until the middle of the third of six episodes, which begs the question, who's taking care of these parks? Yosemite and Yellowstone and Crater Lake and Rainier and some of the early national parks. Well, in some cases, at Sequoia and Yosemite in the Sierras in California, it's African-American buffalo soldiers, those celebrated cavalrymen who were dispatched from the Presidio in San Francisco in the first decade of the 20th century because no one was taking care of the parks, and poachers were coming in, sheep herders were grazing, people were chopping down the trees, killing the bison out in Yellowstone. And they, these African-American buffalo soldiers, in a decade when more African-Americans were lynched than in any other time in our history, were telling people, mostly white people, what to do. That's one of the hundreds of stories we tell in this series. And so we're thrilled to be able to support the great work of the National Park Service and the amazing dedicated rangers who are, next to our military, the most beloved and admired of government workers. But we also have to say, for a long period of time, this was just a haphazard collection of set-aside places that had no rhyme or reason and no sort of vision. And what happened in 1916 is this millionaire PR genius named Stephen Mather, who himself suffered from debilitating breakdowns that were cured only by time out in the restorative national parks, came on and helped create the National Park Service and set in motion this amazing agency that we love so much today and want to see supported and funded to the full level. And the Obama administration, to their ever-loving credit, has expanded the budget of the National Park Service, have directed some of the stimulus monies, but we're going to have to do a lot more to retire that $8 or $9 billion worth of deficit that the parks desperately need in the roads, in the buildings, in the campsites, to bring them up to snuff so that they can truly reflect what they are, as we say, the subtitle of our film, America's Best Idea.
And also the idea that there is an effort to have the national parks become more green. That certainly is going to take a lot of doing.
You know, this evolution of the idea, it's never static. It's always moving. You know, and we were worried for a long time when the attendance was rushing that we were loving our parks to death. We created some wilderness parks with no roads that make it harder for people to get in. We require them to leave no trace of their presence there. That's terrific. But we also want these great wonders accessible to people. And so we're looking for solutions. You know, at Zion, there were traffic jams and smog and congestion, and we just banned cars. And now you ride a bus up there, and there's a little bit of complaint in the beginning, and now everybody does it, and you get to sit on a bus and meet your neighbor, and we're all equal there. You could be a billionaire, or your mama could be changing the sheets in the local hotel, and you're an equal person. You're a co-owner of Zion National Park, and that's the thrilling part, is that we're learning how to be better stewards. And I think, as the writer Terry Tempest Williams says in our series at the very, very end, that the work right now is not so much adding new parks, we can do that, but to restore them, that they heal us, but we are now obligated as citizens of this democracy, this complicated republic, to make sure that we've provided enough for their care. And the initial thing requires us just to get out there and to see them. And once you do, there's no beautiful picture of Ansel Adams, no amazing panorama from our film, no early 19th century photograph that does justice than as I just was 2 days ago with my little girl, 4.5-year-old youngest daughter, hiking up to Delicate Arch in Arches National Park at sunset and sitting with 250 fellow citizens of this earth and looking at in marvel at what we had saved. Because think of it in the other way around. You know, it's like the movie It's a Wonderful Life. We could be Potterville. And we're not. We're Bedford Falls, you know? If we had not had the national parks, there'd be no bison. They'd be extinct. They'd be like woolly mammoths stuffed in some museum. But we didn't. We had Yellowstone, and we saved them. We bought them back from the brink. If there'd been no national parks, there'd be mansions of the rich lining the rim of the Grand Canyon. We wouldn't have access. If there were no national parks, Zion and Yosemite, two of the most beautiful places on Earth, would be gated communities. If there'd been no national parks, Yellowstone would be some amusement park with geysers going off, but ridiculous rides. But we didn't. We aspired to do something else. And we did it not just for ourselves, but for posterity. And that's the great gesture that we made when we founded our country, and we're still trying to live up to those difficult promises. And the parks reflect that, and why we think they're the Declaration of Independence applied to the landscape. It's just an ongoing work in progress.
Ken, when I see you talk, I think I see tears in your eyes. I know I have them in my eyes.
Well, I love these places, and you know, and if we take them for granted, they'll go away. You know, they'll go away. You know, already in the last administration, there are plans to bring in more snowmobiles into Yellowstone. Now guns are permitted. You know, power plants are proposed adjacent to them. These are the fragile environments that reflect, you know, may have started off as spiritual and then moved to conservation and then patriotic and economic development. And now the complex ecological and environmental themes that we talk about, including climate change. But these parks reflect them so easily. They're the canary in the mines that the miners in Telluride used to, you know, take down there just to know things were all right. And the parks are the bellwethers of our health, not just in a natural sense, but in a psychological sense. And if we just take them for granted, if we let them slip away, if we let these, that acquisitive and extractive part of us that's always there, you know, that wants to cut down those trees for the lumber, that wants to extract that mineral that's going to be gone, the parks are our permanent pipeline. As long after the oil's gone, they'll still be there, but only if we are all jealous stewards of them. And that's what we hope they see. I want every park superintendent mad at me because he's got more people coming to his park than he knows what to do with, or she knows what to do with, and that then they have to find a democratic solution. More people is actually good than no people, because if there are no people, then those people, other people, will start eating away at the edges, and one day we'll wake up, and just as we worry about our liberties that require eternal vigilance, we'll find out that our parks disappeared, and if they disappeared, we're gone. We're lost. It's hopeless.
You mentioned Terry Tempest Williams a little while ago, and I think it's important to say that you have a book coming out about the national parks, and you have expanded interviews in the book, and you also, I believe, have an interview or a piece with Terry Tempest Williams.
We do indeed, and she's wonderful. We had interviewed her for our History of the West back in the mid-90s, and we love her. She's a beautiful person inside and out. And yes, our book is coming out Labor Day, and it is a standalone thing. If we'd never made the series, this book would be, I think, the single best book on the national parks. And it is the narrative history. It's lavishly illustrated with a Vietnamese, Parisian-born Vietnamese descent photographer named Tuan Long, who's visited all 58 of the national parks with his large format camera and taken exquisite pictures. And we tell a little story about him in the film, but we also use his pictures in the book and lots of archives that have never been seen before. This wonderful, rich narrative, which I hope I've been able to give you little slices of. And it's really standalone. If there'd been no series, the book would be all right. And it's out Labor Day and has expanded interviews with not only Terry Tempest Williams, but Gerard Baker, a Native American Hidatsa Indian from North Dakota, who's now the superintendent, ironically, at Mount Rushmore National Park, the beautiful Black Hills stolen from the Native Americans so that the bus could be carved. And so you interpret those busts a little bit differently when you have a Native American superintendent there, and many, many other wonderful people who've helped us along the way.
Ken, I was going to take a break, but we're on such a roll here, and I know you're super pressed for time. I'd like to jump into your relationship with Telluride.
It's like a lover. I live in a little village in New Hampshire. I've lived there for 30 years. It's my home. It's where I make all the films. I spend most of the time on the road traveling across the country. But if I had to be in any other place, it would be with my lover, Telluride. And this is my 20th straight year of coming to the Telluride Film Festival on Labor Day weekend. But I learned very quickly 20 years ago that you come a week early so that you can hike Judd Wiebe and Bear Creek, and you can have leisurely dinners with the many, many friends I've met here and people who I've come to love and adore and are the closest to people in my life. And I've raised my two older daughters grew up here. They came, my middle gal when she was 3.5 and my oldest when she was 7.5. And now I have a 4.5-year-old, and this is her fifth time in Telluride. She came as a 6-month-old baby, and she lights up here. She can remember. She says, "This is the place where the green cups of green glasses of Rustico." She wants to go to Rustico, or she'll hike up to Cornet Creek with me, or something like that. And
Or ride the gondola
into the mountain village. I love this place.
What do you think it is about Telluride that is so special for you?
We would have to be probably like a Ken Burns series, like a multi-part, 6-part, 12-hour, for me to do full justice. Let's start with the obvious. Could you name a more beautiful setting for a town in the United States? Second, could you name a town that understood its unique relationship to that spectacular natural scenery and done its best? As much as it's, failed, it succeeded. And I know people who live here day to day are filled with what ifs, but it is still managed to hold on to this essence of what a town could be, where you know your neighbors, you support them, the money goes into education, into parks, into ways that make our lives better in every single way. And I think I come away from Telluride each year with a sense of what the possibility of our commonwealth as people could be. And then you add all the folks who have gravitated here over the years for a variety of reasons, some obviously to make a lot of money off the spectacular scene, but so many of us to sort of have our molecules rearranged in this spectacular environment. There's no other reason to explain why the Telluride Film Festival happens to be the best film festival on the planet than it all those combination of those things and the unique and iconoclastic people who came together to create the festival that do it in a different sort of way. So it's not a meat market where it's all about the parties or celebrity or media or thousands of films where you can't possibly see, but this intimate jewel of a thing, just like the place that we're in, that paradoxically asks you to take your glance away from these spectacular mountains and to go into dark rooms and the sacred communion that takes place in those dark places with strangers and see great art and be transformed as you walk out and look up and are reminded of where you are on the planet and then go into the next dark room. I mean, literally, we'll go on for hours rhapsodizing about this magnificent place.
And, of course, you have clearly a tremendous relationship with the West.
I live in a little village in New England, but I spend most of my life traveling out into the country, and I'm drawn inexorably to the West. It's the place where so much of the mythology, but also the reality of who we are as a people, was born and founded and continues to grow, and the spectacular places that in many cases we have been able to save sustain me and keep me going. I've been dealing with a complicated American history, and that often digs up things about race, but it also digs up things about space and the way in which the physical geography of the United States works on our spirit, works on our soul in interesting ways. And I can't pretend to know what that is. I just know there are lots of good stories out here, and I'll keep coming back to try to tell them.
May I ask you what is your next project?
Well, being freelancers at heart, we've already got them overlapped because, you can't ever not be working. And so we're in the middle of editing an update of our baseball series, what we're calling a 10th inning. In 1994, we came out with 9 episodes, which we called innings. And baseball's a perfect mirror of the United States, good and bad. So when you're in a Viagra culture and there's a steroid scandal, there's a connection there, If there's a pill for everything and the drug companies are trying to tell you, inventing stuff, it seems to me, diseases that we never knew we had so that you could take a pill, is it any wonder that some of our best ball players bears are also taking something to make themselves bigger and better and that way. So we're trying to get into that complex dynamics. It still remains the best game ever invented. We're doing a history of Prohibition. We're working on a story about the Central Park jogger case of 1989 that brings in those themes of race. We're working on a history of the Dust Bowl, the first great man-made ecological catastrophe superimposed over the worst economic crisis in the history of the world, which makes it a kind of double whammy for the folks that are still clinging to the panhandle of Texas and Oklahoma and the surrounding states, including Colorado and the diaspora, mostly in the Central Valley in California, where they fled to try to just keep their family alive in the midst of that cataclysm. We're doing stuff on the Roosevelts, both Theodore and Franklin and Eleanor, and also eventually we'll, you know, grit our teeth and suck in our guts and try to take on yet another war in Vietnam. It's time now that we not have a journalistic relationship to it, but a historical one. And those veterans who saw those bad things, who did those bad things, who lost the good friends, who were scared and bored, hot and cold, who weren't sure their officers knew what they were doing, weren't completely convinced they had the right equipment, as all soldiers since the beginning of recorded human history have felt, need to start telling their story of what takes place in combat. If you don't have accurate records of combat and you've begun to gloss it over with myth, then it makes us more susceptible the next time the guys who never do the fighting say, hey, let's have a war. They never do the fighting. They don't know what the cost is. And if we constantly remind our people what the cost is, then we maybe be able to put on the brakes and say, you know what? It's not worth it. I don't want to lose my son.
Wow. I know the effect I had when I saw the war premiere here at the Telluride Film Festival 2 years ago, I believe it was, then watched it throughout the fall on PBS, and that was very profound. So,
you know, and the thing is, let's not be Pollyannish about this. We're never going to get rid of wars. They're always going to be wars. And in some cases, like the Second World War, some wars needed to be fought. I mean, perhaps there would have been some genius somewhere that might have been able to slow that down. But human nature propels us to war. I'm saying let's just learn as much as we can about the really horrible stuff of it so that we can at least make sure that the wars we fight are the necessary wars. And, you know, the first episode of The War was called A Necessary War. And, you know, I'd love a world in which that didn't happen. That's not going to happen. And it's pie in the sky to think that human nature won't drive people into defensive postures and then into aggressive action. And when that's done collectively, we kill people in great numbers, and that's called a war. That's going to continue to happen. But let's evolve just a little bit so that maybe we can restrain ourselves from those unnecessary ones like the one in Iraq that we were forced into for such a horrific long period of time.
Ken, I'd like to say, thank goodness you're so young, because you have so many projects in you, and I know so many more to come, and we'll all be enjoying them for years, I'm sure.
Thank you. You know,
thank
I always
you
think
for all the work you do.
I always think that if I were given 1,000 years to live, and I won't, I'd never run out of topics in American history to tell. So there's always another good story just around the bend.
I have been visiting with Ken Burns, and you can learn more about really most of Ken's projects at pbs.org, and in particular, check out the national parks. And Ken, is there anything you would like to add?
No, it's just so great to be able to spend some time with you, and thank you for giving me such a spectacular microphone that Kodo is to, like, speak to my friends and future friends about things I care about.
It's a thrill to have you here at the Kodo Studios, and continued success with all your projects, and I look forward to watching the full series of the national parks and your upcoming projects.
Great,
bravo.
Thank you so much. I look forward to hearing what you think of the rest of it. Thanks.
Take care. Welcome back to Travel Fun. Thank you again to Ken Burns for the interview and especially for having accorded me so much time. I know he's super busy these days, always. And thank you again, Ken. That was great. I hope I didn't sound too gaga over him, but I love his work. And I highly recommend you check out his series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea, that is going to be aired on PBS end of September. And you can go to pbs.org to find out more. I am going to be blogging about Ken at my website blog, and that is bonjourtelluride.com. And I might be giving more of a little bit different perspective from what you might be reading in the big dailies. So check that out, bonjourtelluride.com. And my next show will probably be focused on CODO fundraising, although it will be a tape program, and I hope to have a couple of professionals in from the hospitality industry and just talking about what makes for a fine hotel experience or a fine restaurant experience. But I still need to have that confirmed. And we are soon embarking upon CODO fundraising. You can find out more about that also at my site, bonjourtelluride.com. And I am going to be posting some travel premiums. And in exchange for a pledge, you can snatch up a hotel stay or perhaps a train ride or a restaurant and by making a pledge to CODO. So keep checking my site throughout September, bonjourtelluride.com. Thank you for listening, and take care.